Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Anger, despair, anxiety, helplessness. Research shows that people respond to constant media coverage of tragic and traumatic events with these despairing and distressing emotions. And it's how many of us are feeling right now.
Russian forces pounded cities in Ukraine today.
As this war gets uglier, Russia's tactics are becoming more violent and destructive.
Russia's offensive tonight is growing more indiscriminate and destructive, raining down on Ukrainian towns and cities.
Kharkiv's central square, named Freedom, now mostly rubble and dust.
The source said that Vladimir Putin intended to take the whole country and that the worst was yet to come.
Each day, more die. Each day, more flee. Men separated from their families, parents making desperate choices, children bedding down for the night in subway tunnels, and citizens resisting with awe-provoking courage. The people of Ukraine are suffering as Russian forces destroy their homes and communities inch by brutal inch. And here, as we helplessly bear witness to the violent, senseless Russian invasion of Ukraine, our own understanding of the world is disrupted. And our empathy for those in the line of fire undermines our own sense of safety, security, and predictability. So we asked, what's keeping you up at night as you watch the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
What keeps me up at night is how the people of Ukraine are doing and what I can do to help, practically.
Who knows what Putin is going to do? My worry is the nuclear options.
I worry about all the people, obviously, especially, you know, the women and children being without their fathers.
My fear is that Russia is going to win and it will become the beginning of the end. And I also certainly worry about the effects this will have on our next election.
Nuclear weapons and thoughts keeping me up at night.
My biggest concern is that Russia will not stop with Ukraine, that they will move into the Baltics, that they will move into other countries bordering Russia.
The only thing that really concerns me about the Russian invasion is that it could so easily spread into World War III.
And we are right here with y'all in this worry. Here's some of what the team of The Takeaway had to say about the toll of telling these war stories.
I'm worried about the trauma the youngest Ukrainians are going through right now and will experience for years to come, because although war may be started and finished within a certain period of time, the effects from it last for a lifetime.
I'm really concerned about all of the people being displaced right now, because it doesn't seem like the world really has a grip on how to help refugees when they're in crisis.
What happens next? I'm concerned about what Putin can do after this if he gets away with this. It keeps me up at night, to be honest.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we begin today's Takeaway by asking, how can our empathy be helpful? And how can we transform our anxiety into action? Christine Berzinya is head of geopolitics team for the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Christine, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So let's begin by trying to just get a grasp on what is in fact happening. Do we have a sense of what the ultimate goals for Vladimir Putin are here? Is it to hold Ukraine? Is it to push beyond Ukraine's borders?
It's always a little bit difficult to speculate what very long-term goals might be, but there are a few pieces of clarity. Ukraine is very important for President Putin. And since last summer, he wrote an essay, which was distributed to the Russian troops in advance of this invasion, about how the Ukrainian people and the Russian people are one. Ukraine is a very emotional issue for President Putin because of the historical ties, because of the fact that the Russianness in some ways is seated in Kyiv in an interpretation that President Putin takes. So Ukraine has very particular status in President Putin's mind. And he said in a conversation this week with President Macron that he intends to take all of Ukraine. What he is telegraphing is a maximalist view for a Russian takeover of Ukraine. But why? And why is he pursuing this? Why does it matter for Ukraine not to be a democratic country under President Zelensky? In President Putin's mind, the fact that Ukraine is a true democracy is a Western imposition, a Western aggression against Ukraine and against Russian-speaking or Russian cousin peoples, brother peoples in Ukraine. And that is where this rhetoric of denazification comes in. When the bad thing the Nazis did, from President Putin's perspective, the worst thing that the Nazis did was invade Russia and take Russian cities. That kind of denazification really means more of a de-Westernification. And what President Putin seeks is to de-Westernify Ukraine, which the Western orientation and the fact that Ukraine would want to be democratic, would want to join the EU, would want to give its citizens agency, this doesn't really make sense to President Putin and the worldview he has. So what is he after? He's after a Ukraine that looks like Russia, a Ukraine that would never stand up against Russia. And that is an emotional point for him. Of course, he dislikes the existence of NATO. He is concerned about any future stances from NATO, from Europe, from the United States against Russia. But those are in some ways secondary to the deeply emotional sense of violation he has from Ukraine being on this European path, on this democratic path. So on the question of what does he want, firstly, he wants Ukraine to be in his orbit and look and function like a country he would run, even if he does not do it directly, but through some kind of puppet regime. And then those secondary objectives, taking down, delegitimizing NATO, those are important, but I would say not in the first tier of objectives right now.
I want to build a bit on your insights here about Putin's anxieties around the EU and NATO. I want to play a call from one of our callers who's actually asking us a question about that.
Hi, this is Kelly. I'm calling from View Park, Los Angeles. I don't understand why Ukraine is not allowed to join the EU. If not NATO, why can't there be a way of fast-tracking them in or giving them a provisional admittance so that the rest of Europe can come and really help them?
So what's happening with that?
We've seen remarkable support for Ukraine from Europe, and the way that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has led to a complete policy turnaround in security policy, foreign policy, on the question of Ukraine's admission to the EU. These questions have been suddenly seemed completely possible in many ways. The question of the EU membership for Ukraine is very much on the table right now, not for an automatic admission, because there's a very technical process by which all elements of policy have to be harmonized with EU policymaking, but could Ukraine have an express status change to become an official candidate country? All that requires is political will. And there is a tremendous amount of political will across the European Union right now to say Ukraine is one of us. The president of the European Commission, this is the sort of technocratic body in the European Union, had said that we want Ukraine. And that is a tremendous step forward in the sense of Europeanness for Ukraine, including as a member of the EU. So it is possible with the right political will in the near term for Ukraine to be named a candidate country and for its European integration to be formally accepted by the full European Union and its member states. That won't provide it that status of being a member just yet because of how technical that is, but the political step forward is possible. And there can be those who would say, well, how is an occupied country possibly going to be a member of the European Union? But, you know, in a post-ceasefire period, there is precedent for a country occupied to join the European Union. And that is the precedent of Cyprus. Cyprus became a member of the European Union because Greece insisted upon it at the same time that Poland and the Baltic states and others joined. Cyprus has been, there's a part of Cyprus that has been, some would say, occupied by Turkey for decades. And yet Cyprus could join the European Union, being occupied, not having the full territorial integrity and sovereignty that the government insists it should have, has not been a barrier for EU admission in the past in the case of Cyprus.
On Thursday night, Russian forces, as far as our reporting tells, Russian forces have on Thursday night seized control of the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. And there was, at least for a short time, or for some period of time, there was a blaze, a fire at that plant. How real is the threat of some kind of nuclear event as part of this?
I hear that listeners are very concerned about it, and I would say that I am concerned about it as well, as are people across the globe, among citizens and policymakers. When you have a conflict with a nuclear power, one that is being unreasonable in many ways, there's anxiety about how do you not ratchet up escalation to the nuclear level when especially the conflict becomes so existential to President Putin. And yet there are very many things that would happen before where we are now, and a full-on nuclear conflict. The attacks on the Zaporizhzhia nuclear energy plant were, of course, a concern. And that kind of accident, when you have significant nuclear energy in Ukraine, Chernobyl, I will remind everyone, is in Ukraine. That is a risk. It seems that that plant and that situation is under control. That has not turned into a nuclear catastrophe, but there are significant worries. But in terms of a premeditated escalation in the nuclear sense, there are ways that both the U.S. side and the Russian side are trying to make sure that we don't get there. There's a direct military-to-military line of communication that has been opened recently between the U.S. and Russia. And when we think about how Russia would retaliate, there is a universe of options between where we are right now and outright nuclear war. And that is this area of what kind of economic measures could Russia take in return? Could Russia punish the West by cutting off energy supplies? Could Russia start cyber attacks against the West? All of those feel to me far more likely, and the next steps, should Russia lash out against the West and not focus solely on Ukraine, before we would get into anything like in full-out nuclear conflict. But when you deal with Russia in a moment in which Russia has transgressed against so many core principles of governance that we have lived by for, you know, since World War II, there is this question of, oh gosh, what is next? I think that fear is not unreasonable, but it is still, I think, a very remote possibility. And what we're looking at in the short term is going to be, and in the medium term, is a back and forth should there be a direct back and forth between Russia and the West in a much different realm than nuclear.
Do you have a sense of what people can do? And I mean this in the broadest sense, that it is distressing to bear witness, but also it feels as though it's necessary to bear witness, to not turn away, because obviously the people of Ukraine cannot turn away. It feels like it's important to understand these geopolitical actors in ways that maybe we haven't fully paid attention to. But I'm also wondering if there is some way that this suffering, this senselessness, can be transformed by those of us who are not directly affected and impacted, whose families are not crossing borders and being separated and having our homes and communities destroyed. Is there something we can do to bring some meaning and value out of all of this?
Some of the things we have seen since the Ukrainian crisis are very good ways to respond to this crisis in a way that benefits and that fixes wrongs in our own societies. Of course, there are direct ways to help, and you have mentioned already the opportunity for donations from human rights perspectives, whether it's donations to in Ukraine to the Red Cross or to UNHCR to manage the refugee flows, or there are good ways to support independent journalism still in Ukraine, so we do get an accurate sense of what's going on the ground, supporting papers like the Kyiv Independent. There's ways to directly give money to the National Bank of Ukraine in order to support the armed forces of Ukraine through the National Bank of Ukraine website. I mean, there are various, depending on what anyone's focus is, there is a way to financially support that. But there's also a question about our own societies. The kind of disorder and division that President Putin is seeking to sow in Ukraine and across the West has in many ways taken hold in our societies. We have had oligarchs spending their money and getting political outcomes that are not really in the West's interests, but are in the interests of Russia and other autocrats. We have provided an opportunity for Russian state-funded media outlets to tell their distorted version of reality to our societies. And we have had politicians across our societies echo the talking points of Russia, denounce core principles of democracy and question the reality of truth, which is something profoundly Putin-esque. Us opening our eyes to the fact that these toxic behaviors exist in our societies and cracking down on that, and or just turning a new leaf and saying we will no longer flirt with autocracy because it leads to the kind of suffering and the kind of behavior we're seeing from Russia in Ukraine. We will learn to live without these ill-gotten gains, as President Biden said in the State of the Union this week. We will reinvigorate our societies in a more democratic and in a more cohesive and healthy manner. That is incredibly important, because when we look at President Putin's aims, not just in Ukraine, but across the world, is for disorder and autocracy and the strongman approach to survive, for there not to be opposition, for people's voices not to matter. And if we start recognizing those same trends at home, be much more resilient against his influence for the rest of the century.
We will no longer flirt with autocracy. Christine Brezinha is head of the geopolitics team for the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you.